طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. The big news out of Palestine in recent weeks is the rumored move by the UN Security Council to vote on a resolution setting a 12-month deadline to achieve a Palestinian-Israeli peace settlement, which calls on Israel to withdraw from the occupied West Bank and Gaza by the end of 2017. The draft was formally put forward by Jordan at the behest of Mahmoud Abbas, the de facto leader of the Palestinian Authority. Sound good? Well, hold on. The most trusted voices of the Palestinian people are sounding serious notes of caution, which we want to explore this morning. We begin with Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada, who sounds the following caution, quote, "Here's why I hope that one of the permanent members, almost certainly it will be the Obama administration, vetoes this terrible resolution. I evaluate any steps related to Palestine through a simple and consistent lens. Does this measure take us closer to the fulfillment of Palestinian rights? All Palestinian rights? These rights are set out most succinctly in the Palestinian Call for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS. An end to Israeli occupation of Palestinian land during and since 1967. An end to Israel's institutionalized racism against Palestinians in present-day Israel, the areas on which Israel was established in 1948. And the return of Palestinian refugees to their land and homes. I believe in a positive vision of a Palestine whole and free, where all people live in a decolonized and reunified territory without discrimination based on religion or ethnicity and without sectarian territorial partition. This is why I have consistently opposed steps to recognize the so-called state of Palestine. Those recognition initiatives are an effort to undo the death of the two-state solution and rescue Israel as a racist Jewish state, as Joseph Mossad explained in an essential article for the Electronic Intifada this week." Unquote. Columbia University professor Joseph Mossad wrote on the Electronic Intifada, and I quote, "What is happening in European parliaments? In the last month and a half, the UK House of Commons, the Spanish, French, Portuguese, and the Irish parliaments have all recognized Israel's eternal right to be a racist state via a much-touted recognition of an alleged Palestinian state within the West Bank and Gaza Strip, the areas of Palestine Israel occupied in 1967. As there is no Palestinian state to recognize within the 1967 or any other borders, these political moves are engineered to undo the death of the two-state solution, the illusion of which had guaranteed Israel's survival as a Jewish racist state for decades. These parliamentary resolutions, in fact, aim to impose a de facto arrangement that prevents Israel's collapse and replacement with a state that guarantees equal rights to all its citizens and is not based on a colonial and racial privilege. Unlike Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who believes he can force the world to recognize a greater racist Israel that annexes the territories Israel occupied in 1967 de jure, the European parliaments are insisting that they will only guarantee Israel's survival as a racist state within Israel's 1948 borders and on whatever extra lands within the 1967 territories the Palestinian Authority, collaborating with Israel, agrees to concede in the form of land swaps. Denmark's parliament and the European Parliament itself are the latest bodies set to consider votes guaranteeing Israel's survival in its present form within the 1948 borders only. Even neutral Switzerland agreed upon a request from the Palestinian Authority to host a meeting of signatories of the Fourth Geneva Convention to discuss the 1967 Israeli occupation only. Expectedly, in addition to the Jewish settler colony, the world's major settler colonies, the United States, Canada, and Australia, are opposed to the meeting and will not attend. Unquote. So writes Columbia University professor Joseph Massad. Now, getting back to Ali Abu Nima on the UN resolution, he continues his analysis. The UN resolution makes the claim that a just, lasting, and peaceful settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict can only be achieved by peaceful means based on an enduring commitment to mutual recognition, freedom from violence, incitement, and terror, and the two-state solution. It insists that the entire question of Palestine be reduced to the question of the 1967 occupation, and that merely ending this occupation would effectively end all Palestinian claims. The resolution uses vague, deceptive, and in some places outright dishonest language that would enshrine in international law the liberal Zionist two-state solution and deal a devastating blow to Palestinian rights, particularly the right of return for refugees. The places it speaks about rights relate to the Palestinian right to self-determination, a vague formula which has come to mean, in effect, a Bantustan state and no more. It also states the right of all states in the region to live in peace within secure and internationally recognized borders, meaning in effect that it recognizes Israel's right to be an apartheid state. As of this writing, there were reports the draft could still be amended in order to try to avoid a U.S. veto. But of course, any further amendments would make it only worse than it already is. Abu Nima goes on to point out that the resolution really undermines Palestinians' right to return to their land and properties, a key element of any settlement, which Israel and the West can consistently try to ignore or denigrate. It only endorses keeping the settlements in place and trying to have Palestinians accept them by offering vague land swaps. Also, along the lines of previous failed peace initiatives, this draft resolution calls for Israeli occupation forces to be replaced by a third-party presence. In the past, Palestinian Authority figures have spoken of asking American or NATO armed forces to take the place of Israeli occupation forces to act as Israel's proxy and protector. In this way, Israel would be relieved of all the direct costs of the occupation, but would continue to enjoy its full benefits. The draft resolution repeats the lie that over the last few years, under the dictatorial leadership of Abbas, there has been important progress in Palestinian state-building efforts. The only thing that Abbas has built is a terrifying security apparatus, a police non-state that collaborates with the Israeli occupation to suppress Palestinians. Such is the oppression and fear of this petty dictatorship that two-thirds of Palestinians in the West Bank are now afraid of criticizing Abbas, lest they be harassed or worse by his Israeli-backed and American and EU-financed militias and intelligence. The vision this Abbas-backed resolution puts forward is the same old prison for Palestinians masquerading as self-determination and statehood that Palestinians have resisted and rejected for decades. The fact that Israel opposes the resolution should not fool anyone. This is because, as Mossad explained, the current Israeli government prefers forcible annexation of all the land to the step-by-step liberal Zionist approach that this resolution embodies. But in the end, the result is the same. Israel gets the settlements and the land and gets to remain an apartheid state, while Palestinians surrender their rights. Abu Nima concludes, "We are now in the bizarre position where the most likely course to save Palestinians from this disaster is an American veto." So that is the take of Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada and Joseph Mossad, professor at Columbia University. Clearly, Abbas is not to be trusted to represent the interests of all parties in the wider Palestinian community. Who will, at any negotiating table, is the major question going forward. The feature presentation this morning is a rather incredible address that Israeli refusenik Sahar Vardi gave at the Tree of Life conference in Cambridge. Sahar Vardi coordinates the Israel program for the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC, focusing on countering the militarization of Israeli society. She has been promoting the coexistence since working as a small child with her Israeli father planting trees in Palestinian villages. Conscripted into the Israeli Defense Forces at age 18, she was imprisoned for her refusal to serve. Prior to her work with the AFSC, Sahar worked with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and the Sheikh Jarrah Solidarity Movement, protesting Israel's eviction of Palestinians from their homes. Here is Israeli refusenik Sahar Vardi.
So first of all, thank you for the introduction. And what I'll try to do in the next 20 minutes or so is try to give kind of the framework in which Israelis are educated, and in many ways try to answer the question that was asked the panel before, what are Israeli soldiers thinking, or what do Israelis have to go through in order to be the ones implementing all the terrible things that we saw before in Yvonne's presentation and Amo's picture from Ida Camp and so on, because I think it's a really crucial thing to understand. If we're trying to counter the occupation, if we're trying to protest it, then we really need to understand some of the fundamentals that allow it to continue. So, as was said, my name is Sahar. I was born and raised in Jerusalem. I today work for the American Friends Service Committee on their Israel program. And what we try to do is counter the militarization of Israeli society. And that's a very big word that I would try to unpack in the time that I have here today. So just a show of hands, how many of you have been to Israel, specifically Israeli cities? Quite a few. Well, those of you who have probably noticed, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the first thing you've noticed coming in from the outside is the amount of weapons on the streets. You walk down the street and you'll have police officers armed, you'll have armed security guards, you'll have soldiers walking around with their M16 assault rifles, you'll have people on civilian clothes walking around with their M16 assault rifles. Some of them might be settlers that have permits to carry arms, some of them might be soldiers on vacation, soldiers when they go home for the weekend take their M16s home. So that means that you go out on a Friday night to a pub, you might very well be sitting next to someone who will happen to have his assault rifle with him when he's going out. What that means is that we are completely used to seeing weapons. The two pictures here behind me, one of them you can see a soldier again with his M16 going to just buy food somewhere. And on the other picture you can see the fighter jet that was decided by the mayor of Jerusalem, the mayor of Be'er Sheva, who was the former head of the Air Force in Israel, the mayor decided that the right decorations for the roundabouts in the cities are fighter jets. So this is the kind of environment that we're very much used to, but if we go more specifically to look at the education that we get, this is probably a very telling picture. This is a worksheet that was given to children in kindergarten to learn how to count. So these are probably 3-4-year-old kids. And what you can see here, and probably have already noticed, that some of the symbols that are used are tanks and airplanes. The symbol at the bottom that has two of them is the symbol of the IDF, of the Israeli Defense Force. But the rest of this piece of paper also includes doves and olive branches. It includes Knesset, the Israeli parliament, the symbol of Israel, the Star of David, the flag of Israel. And any of you had to guess what was the person putting this all together thinking? What does this represent? If you had to give one word, what would that be?
Patriotism?
Zionism? I've heard a lot of things, but seeking peace. A lot of these things they're all kind of the same thing. This is Israel, right? This is what Israeli identity looks like. And Israeli identity is part of its institutions, the symbols of the state, peace, obviously, who doesn't want peace, but also the military. One of the interesting things that we often don't notice about the symbol of the Israeli military, which I'm sure that a lot of you have seen a lot, can anyone tell me what it is? It's too small for you to see there, so I mean, anyone remember? It's a sword with an olive branch wrapped around it. And we kind of skip through that many times, but in many ways, that's kind of how we see the military. The military is not there to try to kill anyone or occupy. It's there to protect. It's there to, in many ways, bring about peace. That's the kind of idea that we grow up with. But by the time we get into the education system, the military is much more present. You can see here two pictures. The picture on your left. Is a picture of a program called Teacher Soldiers. What happens is that because there is conscription in Israel for both men and women, the military finds itself with quite too many soldiers. And what they've been doing since the get-go, since the creation of the military, is they have an educational corps that is responsible, among other things, to teach in schools. So you have 19-year-old, mostly women, who during their military service, instead of being combat or anything else, go into schools, usually underprivileged schools that are understaffed, and are very happy to get free staff in, and they go to teach English or math or Hebrew. So beyond the fact that this also means that these schools get very bad schooling, because it means young ladies might be very clever, but they have absolutely no tools and are not taught how to teach. But beyond that, it means that you will have soldiers in uniform teaching you. And again, this idea that the military is completely normalized into your life is very visible. By the time you get to high school, it's literally everywhere. You'll have soldiers coming in and out of the different classrooms, explaining about the different units. You'll go out to military bases in which different units will try to convince you to try to get into their unit. There's a soldier who's responsible for every year class, so you also always know who to ask. So there's someone in your school responsible for that, and you can go to them. In the 11th grade, there's this week of basic training. So you go out to a school with your to a military base with your classmates as part of school activity for kind of a week of basic training. You learn how to put on a uniform and how to take orders and learn how to shoot. And this is all part of school activity. So really, by the time you've reached the age of 18, you've never asked yourself about military service. You know that you're going to military service. Literally everything until that point has prepared you to that. Just to make sure that this is not some conspiracy about the preparation for military service in the education system. In the written goals of the education system since they were written in 1951 until today, probably the only thing that didn't change is preparation for military service as part of the written goals of the education system. A program that started a few years ago, part of the kind of privatization of the education system in Israel, and trying to have teachers have financial incentives to get better excellence from their students. One of the ways in which that excellence is measured is through military service. So if you increase the enlistment rates of your class, you literally get paid for it. So again, this is not something that anybody's trying to hide. It's part of the policy. What I would like to say is that's probably not the only part of that education, and it's really important to understand the historical narrative that is created for us around that as well. And what you see here in the picture, I guess, is the combination of these both aspects. So what you see here is a general, the head of the South District of the Israeli military, who was retiring, and the lady is the head of the South District of the Ministry of Education in Israel. So they're having this farewell thing, thanking each other for years of cooperation. So again, this cooperation between the military and education. But what's interesting for me is the gift that this general decided to give to this lady. So you have three pictures framed, and I don't know if you can see them in much details, but the picture to the far left is a sculpture carved into one of the gates of the old city in Jerusalem. And what it shows are Jews taking relics out of the Second Temple when the Romans are destroying it. So this is a story of historical religious persecution of Jews. The second picture is a picture from the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising of the little child surrendering. So obviously a picture that represents the Holocaust. And then the last picture is a picture of the paratroopers, the Israeli paratroopers in the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem when they're occupying it in 1967. Now the story that's kind of told here is the story of historical persecution of Jews. This has always been part of our identity. The Holocaust is obviously the worst example of that. And then the fact that today we have an army that can prevent that from happening. That is the role of the army in that story, to make sure that there is no second Holocaust. Another good example for that narrative is in the Hebrew calendar, there's a month between April and May, which starts with Passover. And I imagine most of you know the story of Passover, the story of the Exodus from Egypt. It's a story of liberation from persecution. In many ways, it's seen as a place where the people of Israel are created as a nation out of persecution. And one of the important things about that holiday, that the main commandment is to remember. But one of the songs that we sing together when we have the Passover dinner, and this is our most important holiday of the year, this is our Christmas. So we come, everyone together, sing a lot of songs, and one of them we translate into, "In every generation someone tries to exterminate us." And this is part of what we're remembering. A week after Passover ends, the Holocaust Memorial Day, exactly a week after that is the Soldiers' Memorial Day, and the following morning is Independence Day. And if you want, that's exactly the same story that you see in this picture again. Everyone has always tried to kill us. The Holocaust is the worst example of that. And then people had to fight and die for you to be here today, for you to have a stake. So if you combine that with the idea that the military has always been part of your life, and with the fact that while you're told that everyone has always tried to kill you, and I grew up in Jerusalem in the Second Intifada, people were trying to kill us. You know, we'd walk out of the streets and there were buses blowing up. So it became part of our reality, and it kind of strengthened that idea that we had. But more than that, it meant that we never had to ask ourselves why. You know, you think that you, if someone, why would a 19-year-old Palestinian boy come into Jerusalem, blow himself up, and kill other people with him? You'd think that would be a relevant question. But we didn't have to ask because we knew the answer. The answer is that's what people do. There was a plaque in a school a year and a half ago, that in the middle it said, this is an elementary school, and in the middle it said, who tried to kill us? And then it had different lines, to Pharaoh, to Haman, a bad guy from Purim, to the Greek and the Romans, to Hitler, to Ahmadinejad, and to the Arabs as a whole. So you have this complete, you know, it's everything. It's historical, it's religious, it's present day, and there's no separation between it. So we know why people try to kill us. It's because it's a historical fact. It's just what people do. So that's a lot of kind of where soldiers come from. But I think it's important to look at militarism not only as preparation for conscription, but also what does it mean for the rest of society after military service. Because in Israel today, we have a situation in which the concept of citizenship is combined with military service. So this is just one example of this. This is taken out of the website of a political party in Israel. The second biggest political party in Israel is Yisrael Beitenu. Lieberman, the head of it, is our foreign minister. You might have heard of him. Only good things, I see. And they're talking here about what should new citizens, how should new citizens be defined, and one of the criteria that they add for that is in order to be a citizen, you would have to serve in military service. And this connection between rights and duties was obviously not born in Israel. I mean, it's kind of the rhetoric of the French Revolution in many ways. But specifically in Israel, it is completely around military service. What that means, among other things, is that groups that don't serve in the army, for instance, 20% of the citizens of Israel are Palestinians, they are automatically exempt from military service. What that means is that they are automatically not equal citizens, and that in the public discourse, it's legitimate for them to be second-class citizens because they didn't do their duty, so why would they get equal rights? So a lot of the discourse around the schools being under-budgeted, or municipalities being under-budgeted, is connected to the fact, well, you know, they didn't serve in the army, so they didn't give up their 3 years of their life. Why should they get the same rights? The way tax is calculated in Israel includes if you did or didn't serve in the military. You literally pay less taxes if you did serve in the army. So this is all part of what a citizen of Israel is. Another aspect of that citizenship value is when we look into Israeli politics. Because obviously, in politics, you'll want the finest citizens of the state, which would mean in Israel, you would want soldiers. And a lot of our politicians run their campaigns on what they did in the army. Netanyahu ran a lot of his campaigns on his brother who died in the army. This is kind of how the rhetoric that you use. Probably the best example of this is that since 1967 until today, Israel has had only one minister of defense who wasn't a high-ranking general before becoming minister of defense. Now, you tell that to Israelis, they'll say, well, obviously, it's the Ministry of Defense. You want a soldier to run it. You tell that to anyone else in the world, and they'll say, well, that's supposed to be a political position. I mean, they'll get information from the army, they'll get information from the foreign ministry, they'll calculate things and make a political decision. In Israel, it's very clear that it's not. It's a military decision. Literally, the people who do it are people who, from the age of 18 until they retired in their 50s or 60s, did nothing but military service. So you're going to give them a problem, any problem, say a Palestinian uprising. Literally, the only way they know how to solve it is through a military solution. They don't think outside of that paradigm. So that also influences a lot of our political system as a whole, and probably the best example of that is our ex-chief of staff, ex-prime minister, ex-minister of defense, Ehud Barak. Some of you have probably heard of him. He's a good example for that, first of all, because he did that path of going straight from the military career into a political career, and is still there today. But what he's now shifting into is the private sector. And this is an important part of the militarism in Israel as well, because a lot of these ex-generals go into the arms industries, the private arms industries in Israel. And we cannot talk about militarism in Israel without talking about the militarized economy that's created around that. So the first part of that is military spending. Israel today spends about 20% of its budget on military spending. That's about 6.2% of the GDP of the country. The U.S., which is a very big military spender as well, spends about 4.4% of its GDP. The world average, if you were wondering, is 2.5. So we're all in a pretty bad place. That said, Israel is really one of the highest military spenders in the world. But more important for me than the spending is the income that comes from the military economy. And part of it is thanks to you guys. So you all know that the U.S. gives about $3.1 billion a year to Israel in military aid. Except for Iraq under the American occupation in the last decade, that Israel has consistently been the biggest military aid. The biggest military aid recipient throughout the years. But one of the interesting anecdotes about that, those funds, is that 75% of them have to be bought back here in the U.S., which means that the biggest lobby for that is not AIPAC, it's not the Jewish Zionist lobby, it's Lockheed Martin, it's Boeing, it's the American companies that in the end benefit from the bottom line of that. But more than the USA, the biggest income of the Israeli economy from the military is the export. And today, Israel is one of the leading weapons exporters in the world, ranked in the 10 leading weapons exporters. It's the number one weapon exporter per capita in the world. Today, the number one drone exporter in the world in absolute numbers, which for a small state is a pretty impressive fact. But we have to ask ourselves why. Why can Israel be so successful in its military export? And the reason is that we can prove that it works. So I have this quote from a former marketer of one of the large military companies in Israel who said, "A scenario in which there won't be a large military operation for 20 years will severely hurt the arms industries." And he's just saying it. You know, if we can't test and then show off our weapons in battle, we can't sell them. So just as an example to that, when we saw this summer, while over 2,000 people were killed in Gaza, and hundreds of thousands of people became refugees and still don't have houses to go back to, this is a short list of the weapons that made their first operational debut during the operation this summer. And this is what just a week ago Israel signed $144 million agreement with India. Selling weapons, selling missiles. A lot of them were missiles that were tested this summer, and you can see here in the poster for a drone, the Hermes 450, that it has the yellow stamp on the top of it. What that stamp says is battle proven. This is literally how you market weapons, which means that when the U.S. wants to build their fence between the U.S. and Mexico, then they're going to use Israeli companies like Elbit Systems that have developed the technology for the fence back home, and then they're going to use it here as well. This is also true in, you see, Israeli armed vehicles in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro. It's an international phenomenon. But what I would like to end with is looking a little bit on the bright side of that, if you like. One of the things that this global arms industry that looks very scary to us and something that we almost can't touch, one of the things that it also does is that it mainly exports oppression. And that oppression is slowly used against more and more groups in society. We saw a good example of that this summer in Ferguson. The St. Louis police force, by the way, trained with Israeli police and military, so a lot of the techniques that we saw this summer were actually Israeli techniques. What we see here in the picture is a tear gas canister. Now, the tear gas that was used in Ferguson is the same tear gas that's used to oppress Palestinians back home. It's actually a U.S. manufacturer. It's a company called CSI. But one of the interesting things that happened this summer was you had Palestinian activists who are very used to this tear gas tweeting to their counterparts at Ferguson on how to deal with tear gas. And for me, that's a beautiful thing that we should concentrate on, because that's a place in which we can see how different people who are oppressed by these systems can come together and try to build solidarity to see how they can oppose them, because these systems are very much based on the fact that we are willing to cooperate in them. And right after me, you'll hear from Danielle, who is an Israeli refuser, and will speak a little bit about how hard it is and how important it is to refuse to cooperate with the military itself as an Israeli citizen who's supposed to serve. But it's important for us to always have in mind, how can we refuse to cooperate with that same military system? Most of you will now be asked to sit in prison if you don't cooperate with that system, or you won't be asked to be ostracized by your families. So what we can ask you is to make sure that your money doesn't go into that, that you don't buy products that are produced in the Israeli settlements, or that in general profit from the Israeli occupation, and that you ask your representatives not to be a part of that as well. So thank you very much.
That was Israeli refusenik Sahar Vardi speaking at the Tree of Life conference in Cambridge. Before concluding our broadcast this morning, there is one more critical voice I want to add concerning the recent call for recognition of the state of Palestine by European countries. And that is the voice of Miko Peled, who we have featured on This Week in Palestine in the past. Peled is an Israeli author and journalist. Here is what Peled writes. As the recognition by European countries of a so-called state of Palestine continues, it is becoming obvious that this is nothing but an old colonial trick, dusted and reused. The fact that liberal Zionist hypocrites, the likes of the Israeli writers Amos Oz and David Grossman, are all over it, says it's all. In the triangular relations between the Europeans, the colonial regime in Palestine, Israel, and the Palestinians, all remains the same. As usual, the Europeans profit. Israel is permitted to continue its brutal colonial regime over Palestine, and the Palestinians remain alone. The recognition of the state of Palestine is nothing more than what France Fanon calls the farce of national independence. It provides for a select group of Palestinians the illusion of power with titles like president, minister, ambassador, and the all-time favorite head of security, and it absolves Europeans of their complicity with Israel. There is now, according to some European countries, a Palestinian state. Look, there must be one, for even Britain and Sweden and a few others have recognized it, and they even have a president. Never mind the fact that nothing has changed. Gaza is still under siege with no end in sight. Palestinian prisoners are wasting away in the colonizers' jails. Armed Israeli mobs and the terrorist organization known as the IDF are terrorizing Palestinians. In the Israeli Knesset, racist laws are being passed, and not one refugee is allowed to return. We would all be wise to remember that the recognition of a state that does not exist in order to numb the resistance to a racist colonialist regime is not new. It has been used by Europeans in Africa and former colonies in other parts of the world, and it is always welcomed by liberals among the colonists. Israelis who are free and enjoy the privileges of the racist regime in Palestine like to remember the people like my father, the retired General Matti Peled, and others like him who, while remaining Zionist, called the right of Palestinians to self-determination, but only within a small area, defined by Israel, of course, so that we can maintain our racist regime and still feel enlightened all the same. It works well for those who do condemn Israel and its policies, but still want to see the state of Israel as part of the solution. We hear that the two states are the first step to a single unified democracy, a statement that only demonstrates the ignorance of those who express it. In Palestine, speaking out against injustice is no longer enough. In fact, it was never enough. As people of conscience, we must act for the removal of the injustice and its replacement with a free, democratic system. But many forget that in order to achieve this, there must be a struggle. A real struggle. And not some intellectualized version of a struggle, as is often suggested by some Israeli liberals, is the only way to defeat racist, colonialist regimes. Liberal Zionists, and even some who are progressive, seek to continue to talk and to debate, which is why they like organizations like the Palestinian Authority and the various NGOs that have sprouted in Palestine. They reduce the struggle to a philosophical, political debate on the issues of human rights and self-determination. They allow people to live in the illusion that colonialism can be resolved around the negotiating table. They promote the deception that if only young Palestinian boys and girls could meet and play with young Israeli boys and girls at a summer camp, then one day all will be well. But the young Israelis return and serve in the brutal armed forces of the colonial regime, and the young Palestinians return to the refugee camps, the various concentration camps and open-air prisons that Israel has created for them, and to being unwanted residents in their own land. But as Frantz Fanon writes in The Wretched of the Earth, colonialism is not a machine capable of thinking, a body endowed with reason. It is naked violence that only gives in when confronted with greater violence. My father and the other liberal Zionists were wrong then, and their successors are wrong now, for there is no way to stop the colonial machine once it has started. You cannot contain its insatiable hunger, its lust for power, and its brutal force. That is why a Zionist peace camp is a sham. And that is why there is no possibility of peace with the apartheid regime known as Israel. European governments never liked people who were not white and Christian like them. They have a history of brutal colonialism, of theft of land and resources, and one wonders if Africa and parts of the Middle East would not have been prospering democracies by now had it not been for the murderous, greedy policies of past colonizers. Those of us who care and indeed struggle for justice in Palestine would do well not to fall for the old colonial tricks. Rather, we should demand recognition that Israel is occupied Palestine, that all Israel towns and cities are illegal settlements, and that it is time to free Palestine and its people from the illegitimate colonialist regime known as Israel. That was an article published by Israeli author and journalist Miko Peled. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our full archive of past broadcasts, browse to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.